I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Of the 140,000 Jews who lived in the Netherlands before 1940, only 30,000 survived the war. Today we hear the story of one of those survivors.
Dr. Hedwig Rose is an education specialist and the former director of education studies at Wesleyan University. She's also a Holocaust survivor, having spent 3 years of her childhood hidden in an Amsterdam cellar with her mother and sister. Hedy Rose joins us in our Woods Hole studios to share her story. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. So you went into hiding at age 6. So at that time, you probably weren't aware of exactly what was happening politically and socially in the Netherlands. But you've done a significant amount of research about that time as an adult. So give us a synopsis of the events in the Netherlands that led up to you going into hiding.
Well, the synopsis of the events obviously is both personal and, again, as you pointed out, political, in the sense that the Nazis had already been waging war and occupying countries, Czechoslovakia, Austria, and so on, prior to this time, and entered the Netherlands in 1940. And actually took over and bombed Rotterdam even during the time of supposedly negotiations, and paid no attention to what was the Netherlands' declared neutrality, which the Netherlands had declared also during World War I. When they did so, it was clear that the Netherlands had to capitulate because they were not ready to fight an army.
Now, you've described two events that occurred before you went into hiding that made a big impression on you as a child. One had to do with a playmate and the other with your father.
Would you like me to
yes, would you
share
tell
those?
Us. Yes, please.
The first one was with the playmate. Is that the one
yes.
you're referring to? When the Nazis occupied the Netherlands, they tried, in a sense, to co-opt the Dutch under the guise of basically saying, you people are also Aryans and you're going to want to do exactly as we want to do, which is to eliminate everyone else. And I lived in the ground floor and first floor of a lovely middle-class house in Amsterdam near the Rijksmuseum. And next door to me lived a child about my age, only she lived on the third floor, and so she had no access to the garden. So we played a lot in our garden, and I would come out into the yard, and I would call up to her, and she would come to the garden and a few minutes later. What happened on this particular day is that she came out to her veranda, looked down at me, spat on me, and called me a dirty Jew.
Mm.
And that was my introduction to the awareness of the fact that there was something about being Jewish, which I didn't even know anything about at that point, and that there was clearly a complete 180-degree change in her relationship to me.
Yeah. And you were 6.
Yes.
Well, and what's the memory of your father with your father, the impression?
Well, the incident with my father was the fact that we used to share walks every day, and those walks were especially during the time he came home, which was either then, therefore, just before dinner or just after dinner. And that was a daily tradition for the two of us. And we walked around the neighborhood, and a couple of blocks down, there used to be an open lot, which I remembered always as an open lot. And this particular day we walked by, and I suddenly noticed that it was surrounded by a high wooden fence. And suddenly a door opened in that wooden fence, and out came a uniformed Nazi soldier. And he walked up towards my father, and he asked him for a light for his cigarette. And I, as a small child, was incredibly aware of the fact that my father became very tense. He lit the man's cigarette absolutely courteously and quietly. The soldier said, thank you, and walked on. And my father swore under his breath and called him a Rotmof, which was basically a derogatory term for a Nazi. And it struck me, and I've never forgotten it, because my father was probably one of the most gentle souls you could expect to meet in this real world. And for him to have sworn under his breath, I never, ever had heard him swear in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So I knew that there was something about this confrontation, and I had no idea what.
Yeah. Now, before going into hiding, what were some of the impacts of the Nazi occupation on the lives of Jews in Amsterdam?
Well, one of the first things that they did was they, as I said, they were trying to co-opt the Dutch and therefore didn't have a sort of armed forces occupation, but rather what they had hoped was going to be a so-called benign and cooperative occupation. They appointed a commissioner who was happened to be an Austrian Nazi by the name of Seyss Inquart. And the commissioner proceeded then to appoint various Jews to become heads of what was called the Yotzer Rat, which basically means the Jewish advisory body. And they appointed very well-respected and established Jews, bankers and doctors. No, not doctors, but bankers and political people. And what they did is every time they decided to offer a decree, such as the fact that we could not go out at night, or we could not use the public swimming pools or the library, or we could not go to the market area unless it was a particular hour of the day, or we all had to wear a Jewish star on our clothing so we could be easily identified. They would offer these decrees by means of peddling them first to the Jewish Council and having them become responsible for issuing them. And then later they did the same thing with what they called the call-ups or the roundups, when they said they wanted to have 150 Jews who were going to be transported out to the concentration camps. They would give that order to the Jewish Council and say, produce those 150 Jews. And you can imagine the kind of terrible dilemma that became.
So the day arrived that the soldiers knocked on your door and asked for your father. Your mother knew that the time had come for you to go into hiding. Tell us what happened next.
Well, I think one thing I should preface this with is that the fact was that my father had been rounded up any number of times for questioning. And I don't know who those people were. I don't know if they were the local police, because there was a great deal of collaboration between the civil administration in the Netherlands and the police. And that was another way in which the Nazis hoped to gain the Dutch cooperation. And each time he came back, and I will never know, of course, whether my father was already in the underground and already doing things that perhaps were raising a red flag, and so he was brought in for questioning, or whether it was an intimidation tactic, or I have no idea. The bottom line was that, yes, it was after dusk had fallen and a couple of soldiers came to the door. I don't know if they were Gestapo or whether they were the Wehrmacht or who it was. And my mother opened the door and one of the soldiers asked for my father, who came forward. And, of course, it goes through my mind all the time as to what might have been the alternative. What else could he have done under the circumstances? And, of course, I only know part of the story. He came forward and the soldier took him by the arm down the steps and turned to my mother and said, "We'll be back for you later." Mm. And every day I ask myself, was this a soldier who was trying to do what he can to give her the high sign to get out of there? Was he not doing his job very well? Was he somehow in cahoots with somebody? Or what was going on here? And did he realize that that did open a slight small door for us to get out, which we did?
Tell us where you went.
Well, my mother grabbed a bag and didn't wait for that later sign at all, threw in a hairbrush and a toothbrush and grabbed us each by the hand and, of course, put on our jackets. Now, there was a curfew. We were not supposed to be on the street. We were not allowed to use the trolleys. And, of course, we had this great marker that said we were Jews while we were out on the street. And we walked out of the house and walked across to the Rijksmuseum, the National Museum, which, if you know Amsterdam at all, is this absolutely beautiful Victorian building. And there was a large archway with cobblestones underneath. And we went through that archway to cut into the city area. And I can still remember the footsteps clattering out loud and echoing around. And I was, of course, tired. We were on a very long walk. It was clear because we were leaving from the southern part of the city and moving from this very residential area to a commercial area, which was the western part of the city. And that's where we walked and walked and walked. And the western part was probably developed more in the 30s and had storefronts on the ground floor and 1, 2, 3 different apartments or houses, if you will, on the first, second, and third floor above. And we went to a storefront, and my mother knocked on the door, and to the door came a woman I had never seen, although my sister and my mother both seemed to know her very well. And we were shown inside and quickly rushed downstairs to the cellar. And there, when we came to the cellar, I saw 2 beds. There were 3 of us, but there were 2 beds. And there were several quilts and blankets, which I suddenly recognized as having come from my house. So I knew that my parents must have done something at some time when I was asleep or not there or whatever, thinking there might come the time that they might have to use this, which still resonates in me when I think about the preparation they made and how and when they made it.
Who was the woman? Tell us more about the woman who took you in.
The woman was actually a woman younger than my mother. She had a young son, a 16-year-old son, and she was married to a much older man who was an invalid and who was actually bedridden pretty much in a bed in the wall that you have seen in stereotypic Dutch farmhouse pictures and so on. These people were very, very modest. They had no other home than this small place behind the storefront, which was really designed for a daytime habitation for most people who ran these stores. But this was their home, and the woman had apparently worked for my father when he was a young man and had a banketbakkerij, which is a fancy bakery pastry, as only the Europeans have these fancy pastry stores. He was also actually a baker on various Holland America Line ships, having apparently turned down the pressure to come just one more time on a ship, which later was torpedoed. So they knew her and I did not. My father had given up this bakery and we had now lived in this very lovely home near the museum. And my mother must have been an original feminist because she had a very important job in some sort of financial operation that took over 2 of the main rooms in our first floor and ground floor habitation. And she worked there every day. And the story goes in the family that when my mother's brother came through Amsterdam and said to my father, "Why don't you come with us?" that he said no. He said, "But if anything ever happens to us, will you take care of our kids?" So there must have been a great deal of awareness. And, of course, doing much of this research now, I'm finding that the whole world knew what was going on. The whole world knew what was going on. And for one kind of rationale or another, they chose not to address it. I think my mother chose not to address it as so many Jews in Holland and in Germany did, because they had been very much an integral part of the society. They fought in World War I in Germany and in Austria, and they were very much in both the administrations and commerce and in the professions. When Hitler came around, he basically threw them out, as he did in the Netherlands. Doctors were told they could no longer practice. Lawyers could no longer practice. For a short while, they were allowed to practice and only treat Jews. The schools were closed. I had just started school, which was a great highlight for me. 2 weeks after I started, I was told I could no longer go to school. And now my sister, who was in the pre-university division of high school and studied all the magical things that I thought that I might want to study, Greek and Latin and geometry and history and algebra and French and German and English and everything. And she, being 8 years older than I, had just entered that stage of joy of realizing there was a future and that she could be anything she wanted to and that she could have friends and she could get on her bike and she could go wherever she wanted in the city. But that came to an abrupt end. Yeah. The Jews were first put into a school altogether, at least the high school ones, and then those were closed. Many of the teachers taught at home, trying to keep them up. Jews had to turn in their bicycles. They had to turn in their radios. They had to turn in their silver. They had to turn in any jewelry and money over a certain amount. And we're told that this was just for safekeeping. Of course, the minute they turned it in, it was basically shipped to Berlin.
We are talking with Holocaust survivor Hetty Rose. We'll hear more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Holocaust survivor Hetty Rose, who spent 3 years of her childhood hidden in an Amsterdam cellar.
Other members of your family didn't survive those early days. All of your father's brothers were arrested and taken to concentration camps. Your grandmother was taken from a nursing home. And this was typical of all of the Jewish families at that time in Amsterdam, right?
Yes.
So you lived in this basement for 3 years. When you were 8 years old, your mother died while you were in hiding. Tell us what happened.
Well, the three of us shared those two beds in the basement. Basically, one morning I woke up and sensed that my mother was very cold and realized in some childlike way that she was not her usual self. And I must have been told that she was dead. I think my sister must have realized it. Then, of course, came the terrible question and dilemma about what to do with her body, because people were always basically tempted to be on the lookout for anything that was unusual, like number of people that might be around in some place or other, or people that didn't usually live there and then suddenly came out. And there were Nazi placards all over the city announcing rewards for turning in that information, even a bigger reward if it led to an arrest. And this weighed very heavily, especially on my mother. And I know from my research and from my reading that it weighed so heavily on many others who were hidden in similar fashion that they basically sometimes just ran out of their hiding place into the street somewhere far away from the host family because they could not stand the knowledge that they might all be put to death the next day. Mm-hmm. And somehow or other, in this particular case, Tante Toos, Aunt Toos, the woman who was hiding us, took a doctor into her confidence. And I don't know if it was a doctor she knew or someone who was referred to her or whether it was her doctor. Nothing. All I knew is that he came at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he and somebody who helped him took my mother out and saw to it that she was buried. Mm. And I know that we all lived with bated breath all the next couple of weeks because we thought the next thing we would hear a knock on the door. Now, we heard knocks on the door many times, and we had hiding places within this little tiny apartment that were even more so than the basement, because the Nazis would have these roundups all over town, in neighborhoods, in special places where they got some sort of clue from somebody. And they would basically come storming in the worst possible way. And if you've read Anne Frank, you can probably recall how that was described. And we would end up going, in one instance, underneath the display window and have cases of beer. Actually, they were empty beer bottles because the stores were closed by now. All the stores were shuttered. There was not a thing to eat. There was not a thing to do. There were no toys. There was no radio, no television, no nothing except for some small radio that somehow or other our host family had managed to hide. And we used that radio to listen to the BBC. But we would hide in this section under the display window, and there would be the three of us. And then after things got worse and worse during the course of the war, and the Nazis were taking young German youth, young Dutch youth, and putting them in place of the German soldiers so they could send the German soldiers off to the front. So he then was also...
The 16-year-old son you're talking about.
16-year-old was also having to hide with us, although when he was not hiding, thinking and fearing a roundup, he would go out to the countryside and he would come back with tulip bulbs or sugar beets that he would dig up for food in the farmers' farms out in the countryside. And he would bring squares of peat, you know, the compressed leaves and so on, and we would burn that in a little wood stove because we had no electricity, no heat, no coal, nothing. Mm. It was very bad for everyone, not just us in hiding, except that we were the extras in hiding who weren't supposed to be there. So there was the constant fear of death.
So as things are going from bad to worse, there are, as you mentioned, raids on the homes when the soldiers would arrive unannounced and search. There were also bombings of Amsterdam, but you can't leave the safety of where you're at for a bomb shelter. Even at such a young age, you must have been aware that this was a life and death situation.
I was, and I often think about that because my professional life has been spent in education and children and child growth and development and so forth, and I am often just at a loss to explain this. How did I understand just the tremendous seriousness of the situation, to the point that I recall we were obviously hiding during the day when the store was still open, which was a very short time. We would hide downstairs in the cellar, and at this time the young boy would go out and get ration cards on the black market for potato peel soup, which was about all that was left. But one day he somehow or other managed to get a smoked eel. And that smoked eel was divided into six pieces so that we each could have a little bit. And I had the head. And I got the fish hook stuck in my tongue.
Oh,
I am downstairs in the cellar. And I know, apparently, somehow absorbed the fact that I shouldn't make a noise. And I headed over to my mother and so forth, and she was aghast. And she very slowly worked the hook out of my tongue. But it was the kind of incident where ordinarily a kid would scream or cry at the very least. And I knew not to do that.
So 3.5 years in this basement, how did you pass the time? You're describing the conditions. What did you do?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one that I'm asked very often, especially by young people who can't imagine what it's like without Xbox or TV or whatever. I had nothing, and there certainly were not toys for a six-year-old, and I had only had 2 weeks of school, so I didn't really know reading, writing, and arithmetic. But my big sister, once more, was called to the task to do things for me, as she had all of her life, which initially I resented a lot. And she taught me how to read. And the only books in the house available there were a set of books that belonged to the young boy. And they were written by a man named Carl May, who, apparently, having never come to the United States, wrote these wonderful books about the Apache Indians. And apparently they were amazingly valid. And in Europe, there, at the time, there were all kinds of Carl May groups and advocates and so forth and so on. In any case, I read these six books or so over and over and over again, backwards and forwards and sideways. And that's all I can remember. Mm. We did a lot of sleeping, I think, because we had no electricity, no lights, no batteries, no nothing. Mm. We listened to the radio by moonlight in the evening, late in the evening. And I could always tell when the adults were in pretty good shape after the broadcast. I had heard the words Churchill and Roosevelt and Eisenhower many times. And if they were upset and tense and everything, I could tell it had been after I had heard the words Hitler and Himmler and Goering and Goebbels. And Amsterdam was also bombed quite frequently. And the planes, the airplanes from the Nazis sounded, well, you see it in the movies. You hear it in the movies. And the Allied planes sounded different. Mm. And I remember that.
You mentioned your sister's 8 years older than you. She was an adolescent when this all occurred. Do you think the experience impacted you both differently because of your age difference?
No question. Absolutely no question. There's no question in my mind just from my sheer personal experience. There's also no question in that this is backed by research in other traumatic events that young children go through as opposed to adolescents. Mm-hmm. There couldn't be a more vulnerable time for kids than adolescence. And for her to have her whole world open up in this beautiful way for her and then be closed down as if you pulled down the garage door must in itself have been traumatic in a way that I can't even imagine. For me, it was a borderline coming out of early childhood and perhaps not understanding a lot, and certainly not having that all taken away from me. And for her, it changed her entire entry into the rest of her life.
Mm. You did receive letters from your father, who was in Auschwitz. Do you know how those letters got to you?
Only partly, in that obviously he couldn't have written directly to us because he would have actually pointed a finger at where we were living. There must have been a deliberation beforehand about how things were going to go if this should happen. And some of that deliberation, as I understand it, much later, was also among my wonderful Tante Tos and her siblings, who were very, very opposed to having her do this. And it's hard not to be opposed because she could have been shot in the street,
right?
And her whole family. And 200 other Dutch people who were totally apart from this would have been shot just for show. I think that there was some arrangement that they would take the letters. I think they went from a couple of addresses of being handed off from one to another to another. And I think they were involved. And the only reason I think they were involved is because I know that they were the only ones who knew about this, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. The only people who knew what we were doing and knew about this and knew that Tante Toes was sheltering us. They were also the people who said they would guarantee making sure that some things that we didn't want to have taken from our home. Our home was immediately ransacked and became a headquarters for the German soldiers. Mm. Everything that was in it is gone.
When does the communication with your father stop?
I think it was probably in 43, but I'm not positive exactly. It may have been earlier. I don't recall the dates. I have to go back and try to puzzle out just each thing that happened.
Tell us about, now, obviously this is a terrifying experience for you and your sister, who had to be equally as terrified, maybe more so because she understood more than you did. How did she manage to keep calm around her, keep you calm?
I'm not sure she really kept me calm. She, I think she was kind of caught in the situation where also, again, I refer you to the Anne Frank discussions about the tensions between the adults, mm-hmm. among the adults who were in hiding. Here there were, first of all, two mothers who might not have at all agreed on the way that they handled the kids. And after my mother died, of course, my sister, who was then 17, 16, no, yeah, 16, felt that she was the closest family member and therefore should be more in charge. I don't think that Tante Toes felt that she was ready to be the adult in charge, and so she acted as the adult in charge. I think this was very difficult for my sister. Yeah, very difficult. Tough. It was very difficult for my mother.
Yeah. So new tensions. So there was,
so there was always tension of some sort or other. And I think my sister managed to keep me calm and try to keep moving forward and try to, A, because she understood the situation so much better. Mm-hmm. She knew about the Nazis. She knew what was the possibility if we were arrested. Mm. So it was a life and death issue.
Did she have hope? Did she inspire hope in you that there was hope?
I don't know if I would say that she inspired hope. She was basically not so much of an optimist as I think I became. I don't know if she was originally maybe more of an optimist and that this terrible experience just haunted her for the rest of her life, that you can't count on anything.
Yeah.
Or whether it was already part of her original nature, I don't know.
Yeah. We're talking with Holocaust survivor Hedy Rose. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Holocaust survivor Hedy Rose. I want to talk about liberation. It comes in May of 1945. Tell us what you remember of that day.
Well, what I remember of that day is that we just threw open the doors, I among the first, I'm sure, and ran out on the streets. I had not been on those streets for 3.5 years. And everybody elsewhere all along the street ran and ran and ran, carrying flags they must have hidden in the house and streamers, orange streamers for the House of Orange, and ran to the main drag that ran a couple of blocks away from us, from Amsterdam to The Hague. And all of the army's automotive stuff came down that road, and the trucks and the tanks rolled down, and the soldiers were standing on top of them, and they were cheered by all of us who were standing on the side. And for once I could yell and scream as loud as I could, and no one told me to be quiet, and I could move around on my own, and I could cheer, and the soldiers threw candy off the tanks and trucks and nylon stockings for the girls, and sometimes took a few of the girls along to The Hague and so on. It was just one massive outcry of happiness. And the feeling that I remember is one I have never been able to put words to because it was so emotional. It was so deeply felt, and it doesn't compare to anything that I can refer to. And here I'm only about 9 and a half or so. This is May of 1945. I won't be 10 until the following February, which I actually celebrated in the hospital. And I could not have understood everything, but the feeling, the sensation was just unlike any other.
Now, the woman who was like your aunt, Tante Tos, she sheltered you and your sister, would have welcomed you and your sister into her family, but your mother's brother had immigrated to the United States and had tracked you down. So how did you feel about leaving her and going to America?
Well, I have very many mixed feelings. Obviously, now having spent so much of my life, really, a third of my life with her, she had become very dear to me as well. I didn't want to go to America. I mean, for me, the door was just beginning, and I had just discovered that there was a child only a year older than I who lived across the street, whose father had a bakery, like my father, and she and I became fast friends. And I went to the same school with her, and I started school, and I loved my teacher, and I loved the fact that I was at school and I was learning things. I was actually held back a year because of my lack of any schooling except my sister's. And I was just happy as a lark, and this hospitalization was a rude interruption, but I wanted to get going, and I had a picture of the Queen in my possession and an orange streamer and so forth, and she invited me to come to the farm in the summer and spend a week on a farm in the Netherlands, which was just heaven for me, just heaven.
So it was but your sister had a different idea. She wanted to go to America?
I don't know what she really felt, because I think she basically had become kind of a sweetheart of this young guy, and I think that she and also kind of liked a very good friend of his. I think she was not, I won't say that she was happy, but I think that she was not as unhappy as I was, although we didn't discuss it together. And actually what convinced me was remembering all those books I read about the glory of the Apaches and the courage of the Apaches. And I thought, well, maybe I would meet some of them. And then people told me, people in America are so wealthy, you don't have to darn any socks. You just throw them away if they have a hole in them. And I thought, that was probably heaven. And so that kind of convinced me to stop complaining.
So what were your first impressions of America when you arrived?
Well, the first impressions were of one of overwhelming wealth. I could not believe, I should start by saying the first impressions came after a horrendous overseas trip on this Greek freighter, which was turned into a troop ship, which was now converted into a passenger liner. And I was with a large group of French orphans who went. The food was spoiled, and I got sick again on the boat and had this ancient remedy of cupping performed on me, and I was miserable.
Oh boy.
Coming into the harbor, there was a dock strike coming into New York. So we were turning and turning in the harbor, and I remember the red horse from, Texaco, whoever. I remember the Peter Pan cookies, and the Lorna Doone cookies, and the Peter Pan peanut butter and so forth. I remember all those lights most of all. And then actually we were taken off the boat because it was considered after a few days that the health problems with having all those children on board was problematic. So they took the children off on one of those New York Harbor sightseeing boats and took us into Ellis Island. And there I remember thinking, oh, wow, there were people standing there with gaily wrapped presents, and there was one for each child coming off the boat. And I thought, wow, they must really be waiting for us and welcoming us. I mean, they have presents for us. And the presents were three handkerchiefs. I mean, real handkerchiefs, not Kleenex, as we all had in those days, and I had none. And so this was really very wonderful. And one on each side of this enormous house or barn or whatever it was that we were processed through. And my sister was there with her arm around me. She also got the presents, as did everybody. And my aunt and uncle had come to New York to welcome us. But because of the strike, my uncle had to go back to Rochester where he was at work. And my aunt took us to the hotel where she gave us baths and washed our hair. And the people who were washing the windows of the building were whistling. I remember that at that point. I remember going to breakfast with some good friends of theirs the next day going to an automat where this magical thing turned round and round and you had sandwiches you could choose all the way up and down.
From what you had been living with.
Oh, my goodness. And you could go up to the cafeteria line and you could pick out what you wanted. But what floored me was all the things that were thrown off those trays into the waste baskets. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe that people would throw food away. And then these wonderful stalls on the street with bananas. I hadn't seen a banana since before the war.
So as a child, did you talk about your experiences in hiding with your aunt and uncle?
I think not a lot. I don't think they really questioned me. I'm sure they talked a lot to my sister, but they... I still think about how amazing it was for a couple that had no children of their own to take on a 10-year-old and an 18-year-old and suddenly have to figure out how to handle them, given especially those special experiences. I think they had enough sense not to try to dredge up stuff.
What about you and your sister? Did you talk about it with your sister?
Yes, I do remember we shared a room and we did talk a lot. We talked Dutch among ourselves. I talked German with my aunt and uncle because I had learned German actually quite incidentally because my grandmother had stayed with us for a while. So I was 3 years old at the time. I picked up a lot of German. And they spoke German when they didn't want us to understand anything, of course. And at the same time, I was learning English.
So you've spent time researching, as you've been talking about, what was happening in the Netherlands before and during World War II. What has been your focus and you're learning a lot, filling in the blanks. You had your story, but now you're filling in all the pieces around it, right? And you've been researching for quite a while.
Right.
Hope is to put it all in a book at some point?
Yes. Every time I've given a talk, which has been quite a number of times in recent years, I didn't talk about this at all for years. And then I realized it was terribly important to try to answer people's questions, even though it made me feel like something out of a museum somehow, because they were making an effort to understand, and I couldn't blame them for not understanding if I didn't speak. And I had several incidents that sort of brought that to a head. And so finally I began to do this, and I was asked repeatedly and repeatedly. So now I've spoken to all kinds of groups of adults and college students and children and so forth and so on. And one of the many things that came out of that for me was somebody urging me again and again and again to write this down. And I said, well, you know, what the world doesn't need is yet another book about the Holocaust. And yet repeatedly they have said to me, that's not so because everyone's experience was different. And I am now learning that that's indeed true. You can go to Stanford University and read for 5 years, and nothing will be the same as anybody else's story. And that kind of convinced me that pretty soon the rest of us who are still alive are going to be gone. And I've personally seen the difference in understanding that comes when you're able to speak to a live person, to ask questions, to share with them their insights. It's so different from the history class.
Of course, I
can't blame anybody for that. But then again, if I then don't write down these things, they will be forever gone with me.
So I know that you've made all these talks and you're working on this book and you hadn't talked about it for years. So what are people sharing with you what they take away from your story and the stories of other people who survived not only the Holocaust, but genocide, which is still going on in this world? What are they taking away? What are they expressing to you that they're taking away from your story?
Well, I think it depends on the group I speak to and some of the classes that I've been actively engaged in teaching and so on. And the teaching that I've tried to make emanate from sharing the story is one of not only the emotional that you take away from it, but the factual, to teach people to stop and think, to teach people to stop and see what were the maneuvers, what were the ways in which the Nazis were thinking and acting? What did they do that kept people seated and not willing to object? Why were all the nations closed to us? Why were the boatloads of refugees turned back when the only alternative was a concentration camp, was being shoved in an oven, was being gassed? Why was there not enough of a response, a humane response, to what was happening? I mean, when I look around me and I see what's going on, I've become actually very discouraged lately. I wasn't for years. And then coming to America and coming to a place that guarantees certain freedoms, I thought it could never happen here. But I see things that are bordering on stuff like that. And I see that we turn a blind eye to things like that. And I keep thinking, I mean, the United States could have done a lot more. They could have, with no objection to their own soldiers, with no harm to their own people, they could have bombed those concentration camps. It would have made it impossible for them to take 6 million people, not just Jews. The Jews were 6 million, but there were many others. There were Jehovah's Witnesses, there were gypsies, there were gay people. There were so many other people who were being put to death in this way, not necessarily in this way, but they started out doing that right from the very beginning with the very first camps that they started. And I don't know what it takes to communicate that, to get people to take action. Now, to take action is difficult, and I have the same problems myself very often, and it becomes overwhelming. But to have a government lead in the blind eye has given me a great disappointment, both in my own country, the Netherlands, and in what is now my country, the U.S. And you know, leading at times as we have, as Clinton did, for example, in Kosovo, I applaud that move. I really applaud that move. And I, every time I see something about any of the wars, I say to myself, how can we try to exist and to survive all these cataclysms like rock slides and mudslides and tsunamis and horrible hurricanes, and yet we still go out and slaughter people like it was nothing. Nothing. And every one of those 6 million people has no voice anymore. And so I feel absolutely the responsibility to keep those memories out there and to tell people, you know, that's what they were doing then. Let's look around now and see what they're doing now.
Well, I'm so glad that you did decide to share your story. I look forward to the book and thank you so much for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.